Hello everyone, and welcome to our fifth episode. My name is DTwit, and you can follow me on the Twitters at D_Twit. First, some podcast-related announcements. 5 weeks ago, I started talking into a microphone, having never done podcasts or any sort of broadcasting, and basically hoping for the best. I called the podcast The Desync because it sounded at least semi-related to my not-very-imaginative Twitter handle, and I figured that just in case Julie Mason hated the idea, or I turned out to have all the vocal charms of nails on a chalkboard, I could always retreat and slip back gently under my rock. Well, except 5 weeks later, not only am I having a total blast talking to my Twitter friends, but there seems to be an audience for our undertaking. The Pooligans hashtag stuck, and so today we are officially announcing that we're changing the name of the podcast to hashtag Pooligans. Makes sense, right? I'm also excited to announce that this week, for the first time, we'll have two podcasts for you. Our weekend edition will bring together Pooligans old and new to discuss the stories of the week that resonated with us and some that we felt were perhaps overlooked. I hope that you'll enjoy our new artwork, check it out, and find all the hidden cameos. But most of all, I want to thank you all, and of course Julie Mason and Patrick Faris and the POTUS Press Pool on Sirius XM Channel 124 for inspiring all of these shenanigans. I hope that you do enjoy today's episode. I'm sure you have heard both of the names of the two gentlemen you're about to meet many times on the program because they send Twitter questions and comments all the time. And I also hope that you'll join us again on the weekend for that elusive first weekend edition. Without any further ado, let's go to the bouncy bumper and meet our two splendiferous Pooligans. All right, welcome back to episode number 5. That means we actually have guest number 9 and 10 for you today. And we're going to get straight into it because I have a feeling this one's not going to be a short episode. Our first guest grew up in Michigan, enjoys hiking, cooking, and occasionally soothing crying babies, even if it means throwing his own back out. He boldly claims that The Dark Knight is nay unwatchable unless Heath Ledger is on screen.
Fact check, that's true.
Refers to the NRA as a LARPing organization and called the venerable Ruth Bader Ginsburg, quote unquote, selfish. He's a strong proponent of putting a riddle in one's suicide note, because if not, then why even bother? He, dear listeners, is the rarest of breeds, a self-professed socialist who is both intentionally hilarious and was once a working attorney. You've heard his Twitter handle countless time on the POTUS Press Pool, so follow him immediately at Bull Goose Party. This is the one and only Adam J. Adam, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Happy to be on.
Happy to have you. Our second and long-anticipated guest has, at the tender age of 52, just completed his first marathon. He's a father of 5 who 13 years ago up and left his city life in Massachusetts and moved within spitting distance of the Canadian border in the countryside of Vermont. A story so good that we'll ask him about it a little later. He has sold pickles, veggies, fruits, jerky, jams, and jelly, and has nurtured rabbits, goats, and chickens. But in his day job, he's an adjudicator for the INS, otherwise known as the Immigration and Naturalization Service. His name is Joe, but all Press Pool listeners know him by the only Twitter handle that Julie Mason pronounces in the style of Marlon Brando. And so you absolutely must follow him at Joey Tomatoes. Hey, Joe.
Very nice. Thank you.
Thank you. I practiced that for so long. So usually we start this roundtable with a question about your politics, which we'll do in a second. But since I'm experiencing severe Twitter handle envy, we will talk about your Twitter handles first. So my Twitter handle is neither clever nor evocative. It's really barely utilitarian. But you two managed to both pick great Twitter handles. And so I'm going to need a breakdown real quick on how you came up with them or what inspired your Twitter handles. So Adam, let's hear it. How did Bull Goose Party come about?
Oh, sure. It's a, you know, just a play on the old Bull Moose Party. And then Bull Goose is like an old timey depression type slang for like a boss. I know I stole it from a Stephen King novel, Green Mile, I think. So that's just the lowest of humor a pun.
No, but that is very venerable. Love Stephen King, and The Green Mile was a fantastic work that most people still don't realize is actually, just like Shawshank Redemption, they don't realize that that's actually by Stephen King. So kudos to you.
Thanks.
That is a name of good provenance. Joy is Did you also find your name in a Stephen King novel, or where did yours come from?
Actually, mine goes back to second grade. Oh, no, first grade. I'm sorry. My name is phonetically D'Amatos, and the very first day I showed up for first grade, somebody said, Joey Tomatoes, D'Amatos. And after that, all the kids made fun of me, and I became Joey Tomatoes from that point forward.
Oh, that is adorable. That is adorable and cute. I did not see that one coming. All right, so that's perfect. You did a much better job, both of you. Let's start with the real opener. And this one, in this particular case, is going to be extremely interesting. So we'll start with Adam. Adam, where would you say, before we get into the POTUS press pool business, do you stand politically?
Yeah, I'm a it's a new experience for me after having gotten a little more radical through as I've gotten older. I'm probably on the conservative side of socialist. So like I'm a very traditional social democrat. I Norway sounds perfect. All the revolution is fun to talk about. But I've always been lefty, but unlike the common wisdom, have not moderated as I've gotten older.
Mm-hmm. That sounds okay. That sounds good. Have you been to Norway?
No, I never have.
It's worth the trip. If you want to meet your socialist brethren, there are a few better places to meet them than in Norway, which is truly a beautiful country. I highly recommend.
Yeah, unfortunately, it just seems like socialism works so well in places where it's so cold.
That is true. But you know what? In the summers, it is absolutely gorgeous. Oslo in the summer, we just did that actually. I actually took my kids last summer, and we actually did Scandinavia finally for the first time, and it was just beautiful. Highly recommend. My friend Joe, where do you find yourself on the political spectrum, would you say?
I hope you don't mind a bit of a story, because it started back in high school. I was probably what would somebody call a Reagan Republican. I was into the Republican version at that point in time. And then I joined the military, and I ended up over in England, and I lived in England as a civilian for a while. And while I was there, I tended to become more liberal in the economic fashion, not so much in the progressive fashion. Currently, if you were going to nail me down to a position between an economic liberal or conservative or a social democrat or conservative, if you hold down a pole in the middle of all of that, I lean one way or the other, but holding on to that pole. I tend a little bit social conservative, but I tend to be more economic liberal.
The venerable pragmatism.
Yes, exactly. Adam, how do you remember how you became a Pooligan, or do you remember the moment that Miss Mason came into your life with her show?
You know, I don't really. I'm a complete political junkie, so I've just been devouring, you know, any political news whatsoever. And I know I started listening to her show fairly regularly before I even thought maybe about tweeting in or whatever. And then I did and got them occasionally read, which is fairly addicting. And now I listen to it pretty regularly, but I'm a completely anti-cable news person. I don't believe there's any value to watching it whatsoever, unless there's like something breaking at the moment to get kind of a sense of the reaction, whatever. So it's such a better way to get news by hearing it from actual reporters.
Totally, totally agree. Joe, how about you? Do you remember when Miss Mason arrived in your listening universe?
You know, I can't remember the specific moment, but this much I will say. The moment that I really became a Masonite or a hooligan was when I realized that I had access to somebody who, A, was not a pundit, and B, responded to her audience. And it's such a great opportunity to actually talk to somebody who knows the business and does respond. Like, okay, so you've heard my name a few times on the press pool, and I really like that. But getting a response from her on a personal level, not so much from a direct message, but from like a retweet or an answer back to a question, really made me understand a little bit more, to expand my knowledge. And that is when I became a Masonite.
Mm-hmm. Yep, totally legit. And we'll actually go into that a little bit later. But yes, that seems to be a common Pooligan experience. The tweets definitely play into the world of the Pooligans. Do you, Adam, what brings you back on a daily basis to listen? We know that it's a 3-hour show. It's on 5 days a week. Do you actually have the chance to listen to it daily? Do you listen to it live? Do you listen to the on demand? How do you consume your Mason?
A little bit of everything, depending on the job. I'm one of those people, I have to have something playing at all time, whether it's music or something while I'm working or while I'm around the house, and news is a great thing to do that too. I guess mostly live for the most part. You know, I tune in as I can, catch up on demand when I need to.
And you need to always, Adam. You need to always. Always.
Like I said, complete news junkie.
Right.
It is a horrible habit.
I assure you there is worse. Joey, what brings you back on a daily basis? Tell us.
To begin with, I became a Smirconish listener because I worked a different shift. And going in, I would listen to Smirconish. I will be honest with you, I am not in love with Smirconish. I'm really not in love with him. However, when I switched shifts, I was able to listen to Julie Mason. And I loved the refreshing point of view. First of all, I never knew, and I still don't, to this point, understand what point of view she has. It's completely neutral. She presents things in a very great way, so that I can see things from both sides. Sometimes I hear things from a conservative version. Sometimes I hear things from a liberal version. But either way, she doesn't weigh in. She weighs in more on honesty and integrity, which is ultimately what I want to hear. And I have learned to just love her no-nonsense. I don't give a crap. You got to give it to me straight kind of version of the truth.
Do you, after listening, do you feel like a better informed listener? And do you share your knowledge that has been imparted on you by the press pool? Do you share that with any of your friends, family? Do they want to hear it? Would they rather that you please do not talk about that under any circumstances? How does that work for you, Adam?
Everyone has already gotten an earful from me. No, I'm not much of a politics debater, unless it's with people who, you know, enjoy it. I truly believe you really can't convince anyone. People have to kind of come to their politics themselves. So I enjoy, you know, talking about it with people who enjoy it as kind of the game. I have a good friend who, you know, used to work in Republican politics, and he and I spar about it, but,
you don't try to convince people who are hard to convince, basically.
No. That way, only tears lie.
Joey, how about you? Do you share? You have a full household to share all of this information with. Does that happen? Does that not happen? How do you play your cards?
So there's a couple of facets here. One, in my workplace, politics is pretty much no go, because it creates too much problems. However, I really like introducing people to truth. So sometimes when presented with whatever clearly not true position somebody might have, I said, well, have you looked at, and then I come up with a specific point, such as somebody was talking about in the last administration, they were talking about an executive order. And I said, all executive orders are actually published right here, and then I showed him where the site was, which was an awakening moment for them to understand that sometimes people politicize things and they might not be on the right side of that politicization.
Mm-hmm.
In my own home, I am frequently trying to teach my children, and this is difficult in this current political format, the reason why somebody made it, was successful, mm-hmm, is because that they were actually pushing forward a popular view, such as Trump. I am not a Trump fan, not by any stretch of the imagination. He's not my first choice. He's not my second choice. And Hillary was neither one of those either.
Mm-hmm.
I want to let my children know that they need to understand where that methodology comes from. Some of the things that Trump brings across, he comes across as very bombast. But a lot of us Americans actually truly agree with the kernel of the presentation. In other words, for instance, trade wars. I mean, none of us really like being taken advantage of. I really don't agree with the way that he's going about things. But is there a reason why we should be looking at this? And the answer is yes. A good section of America does see us being used as suckers when it comes to this specific point.
Yeah, we never had our Napoleon. We've never given it the old shot of, hey, let's let the strong guy fix it. Everyone has that dark impulse, and most other countries have at least been bitten in the ass by that in the past and have learned, and we haven't had that yet.
Right, exactly. And we really need to take a look at both sides. And okay, so he's a bombast, and he is literally not the guy sitting at my dining room table that I want sitting there talking to my children, because honestly, he's a jerk. But ultimately, he does portray a point of view that a large part of America does agree with.
It's what's been interesting to me is how, if you looked at the Pew Research put out a pretty large worldwide research project that had to do with asking questions about Trump worldwide. And what was interesting in that is that almost universally people agreed that he was unqualified to be president, but they agreed by equal numbers that he's a strong leader. If you asked them, is Trump or isn't he a strong leader, that is what they agreed with. Even Scandinavians, by the way, agreed with the fact that he's a strong leader, which to me, especially in this context, seems really interesting, because as you're saying, we've never really had our strong man. Apparently, there was a yearning for that. And I'm assuming that previous presidents, Obama, for example, did not really play to that strong man image. He put across the consummate intellectual who reads everything, tries to know about everything, asks questions, and tries to be either the smart guy in the room surrounded by even smarter guys who will tell him if he falls down. But it seems that, yeah, there was a sizable part of the United States that was holding out for something different, for the guy who just does everything from a point of, I'm the strong guy and whatever I do, that's just what's going to be done. And I'm just going to say the things that nobody else dares to say. And it appears that that's what we ended up with. But as Joy says, that may not mean that he's wrong. It's the approach that perhaps leaves a thing or two to be desired.
You know, people have talked about him as, you know, sort of being an independent president. I totally agree with that. I think he's essentially our first Reform Party president. You know, he essentially ran on the Ross Perot platform. But people, when they talked about third parties, everyone always says, oh, well, you know, we just need this, you know, socially liberal but fiscally responsible party. That will, you know, it's the old Jesse Ventura thing. That's the untapped constituency, but it's not. The untapped constituency is socially liberal socially conservative and at least fiscally welfare statist, or, you know, to that, something to that level. It's a very, you know, we will apply to your fears and hatreds, but also make sure that, you know, you don't feel like you're cut off, because, you know, as you can see, that like the crony capitalism was such a kind of winning argument for him. Whether, I mean, I don't believe he's governed like that at all, but it's kind of the old George Wallace model. It's not the, you know, opinion pages of the Washington Post dream about when they think about their ultimate independent candidate, like Michael Bloomberg. It's Trump or it's George Wallace. It's these guys who will, you know, hey, I'll let you be racist, but I'm not going to touch your Social Security.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, thank you. That was great.
Oh, you see it like, you know, again, other countries have had theirs. Italy had Berlusconi. That's exactly what Berlusconi was. Mm-hmm. It's what Putin is.
Yeah, it's what Putin is. It seems to also be that he himself, Trump himself, has a sort of outsized admiration for people, for the kind of person that he's trying to portray. I think somewhat aggravating under the circumstances is that both Berlusconi and Putin seem to be somewhat more interested in the dynamics of politics and the dynamics of foreign policy than our president appears to be.
I don't think you can underestimate how profoundly stupid Donald Trump is. On like a very, I think it was Fran Lebowitz, she said something like, you know, in your life, you don't even know anyone as stupid as Trump. Like, he's obviously perfectly capable of getting through life. He's not, you know, but he's not an educated person. I don't think he's ever really read a book.
With $1 million.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He's not a smart guy. So he's like a lot of dumb, successful guys. When he's around somebody smart and successful, he parrots what they say so that he can sound smart. It's what, you know, everyone talks about, how he agrees with the last person who leaves the room. That is my unified theory of Trump. Everything can be explained by the fact that this is a pretty dumb dude.
I think it's a pretty sound theory, Adam. I gotta be honest.
Full disclosure, I hated him when he was a celebrity. Like, he's someone I just find, you know, loathsome.
I to this day regret the fact that I actually enjoyed the first season of The Apprentice. This is incredibly embarrassing, and I might cut this out of this episode when I sound edit it, but it's unfortunately true.
I dare you to.
Yeah, no. I know.
No. There will be two posts underneath this particular episode where it's posted, one from Adam in. And one from Joey saying, excuse us, we remember you said something. It doesn't appear to be there anymore. How did that happen?
I remember in the first Republican debate, we all sat down to watch it. You know, oh, let's watch him fall on his face. And he didn't, because you forget, like, yeah, he knows how to do this.
I know. Like, was that not one of the most amazing feats? Like, all of us expected him to show up in the debate and be a complete and utter moron. And he was an utter and complete moron and won.
And won.
How did that happen? I don't know.
I really do believe that it's a lot of my metaphor might be, it's much simpler than Adam's, unfortunately, but to me it always reminds me of the guy at the bar who likes to loudly argue at the table where everybody always congregates. It's always the same four or five guys sitting at the same table and arguing about politics loudly and usually quite crudely. And then one of them wins $1 million and becomes president. And now that guy just takes his bar arguments and just finds people who actually try to support that on an intellectual level. And this is what we ended up with.
I have to ask a question, though. I really do. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
But is this not the prequel to Idiocracy? Have you seen the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is this not the prequel to Idiocracy?
I think we've always lived in Idiocracy. Like, we're, we do dumb that's stuff. Perfect. We vote for dumb things. It's, you know, I mean, that's the one good thing about democracy, is that it's over the long haul fairly self-correcting, you know, barring, you know, incredible cataclysm.
Yeah, no, in the Book of Julie, there's a rule that says never underestimate the propensity of the people in power to shoot themselves in the foot. And
that's a Democratic Party, right?
That's
now.
Correct. And it seems to be also applicable to a nation as a whole. When given the chance, true, they will vote for incredibly absurd things.
Well, and we've never, you know, in history in general, we've never avoided a crisis if it was easier to not avoid it. You know, like, you stumble.
Well, no, because there's always something to be gained by getting into a crisis.
Oh, sure. And something to not be lost by not taking a bold move. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, you really, you know, that's what gets you to the Great Depression. It's what gets you to 2008, because it's easier to kick the can.
Oftentimes, I look at Trump today and I think he's a cartoon version of Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I mean, he ultimately wants to be Teddy Roosevelt, but only bigger and better.
Which is really sad, because Teddy Roosevelt was a cartoon version of Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, sir.
The guy who wants to be, what was he? He wanted to be commissioned as a general in World War I. You know, he was playing.
Oh my gosh, he wanted to roll off going into Europe with on horseback with Native Americans and cowboys,
and would have been happy had he died doing that.
Yes, until his sons died, and then it was a different story.
Well, at least it was that and not bone spur. So credit to him, where credit is due.
I don't know why that should be brought up at every press conference he ever gives. Which foot was it in? Come on.
Mr. President, your spur, where is it?
You're right, nobody gets away with it.
So now that we've pretty much covered everything from historical political systems to Teddy Roosevelt, let us quickly get back here on my little questionnaire. Sorry, I love my transitions; they're so smooth. So as we have last heard, both of you feel better informed by the POTUS press pool. That is clear. We briefly talked earlier about the POTUS press pool. Julie uses Twitter for the POTUS press pool quite extensively and does not really take questions from Facebook, which is a whole other community that I don't believe either one of you does. Either one of you follow her on Facebook?
I don't follow her on Facebook. Facebook is more for family.
Okay, so baby. Well, I guarantee you, in this particular case, it's not baby pictures. It's her looking pretty nice, sitting next to a pool on top of the Roosevelt Hotel. Taking in the Qatari 4th of July hilarious. Goodness.
Okay, so now I'm...
You're missing... I was about to say, you're missing out a little bit. Anyway, so no Facebook love. So how do you enjoy, though, that Twitter interaction? Is it meaningful to you guys? And do you actually try to get your name mentioned on the air? Do you not care? How do you handle your Twitter POTUS press pool life, Adam?
Yeah, it's great. It's fun. It's interactive. You know, it's a... It's talk radio that talks back, and that's great. I don't know. I try and weigh in if I have something to say or something I feel like I could make a point with, but usually it's just a Ted Cruz joke.
Thank you.
Of course.
Those are always welcome. Never a bad time for jokes.
I don't have anything truly, you know, groundbreaking. I have no inside information.
We all don't. That's why we're here and not on the POTUS press pool. I'm sorry. That sounds depressing, but it's true. Joey, how about you? What do you work hard to get your minute of Joey Tomato fame on the show, or do you not care? How do you handle your Twitter beings?
So initially, I got off on the fact that my name was mentioned. And I don't care how many times I have to say Fat Dracula to get it to happen, but you know, whatever. But ultimately, as time has gone on, I've learned to respect the show for more of what it is versus what I get out of it.
That might have to be a clip on the POTUS press pool, actually. That was beautiful. That was heartwarming.
So my ego worked. Thank you.
Oh, nicely done. Sublimated narcissism is a beautiful thing. Very well done. Do you interact with any of the other pooligans, or have you made friends that way, or has anything about the other Twitter followers of the Mason surprised you, delighted you, or depressed you?
I mean, I'm sure I follow a few people and likewise back, but unless, like, I guess we're interacting organically with something one of us has tweeted, I don't believe so. I'm sorry to anyone who has interacted with me and is feeling left out, but like I said, I know I follow a ton of the people on the list that you put together.
Well, let the record show that Adam does not care about any of you. This is a fact. Joey, what about you? Do you interact with the larger Twitter following of the Mason?
Okay, there's some tears rolling down my cheeks right now from Adam.
I just followed you today, Joey.
Joey feels ignored, Adam. You
I couldn't
did
believe
that.
I wasn't following you. You pop up in my feed.
Honestly, a couple people stand out hardcore. One, D-Twit. I follow this guy. I don't know whether you know him, but he's pretty cool.
Sounds useless to me. Stupid handle, too.
I do follow quite a bit of the people that are the hashtag hooligans right now, and it is an astonishingly small community. In other words, I don't mean small as in number, but it's close. And even though somebody like Susan Rhodes, who I happen to love everything that she posts, mm-hmm. yet I don't agree with everything. It doesn't matter whether I agree with it. I love the passion that this group has. And it really does speak to the fact that regardless of whether you're ultra-conservative or ultra-liberal, it doesn't really matter. We all have a place to talk. And we all have a place to talk civilly, which is astonishing in this day and age. And I happen to be very happy with the hashtag hooligan.
Yeah, I will say it's a civility that's earned. Everyone is cool.
It's been really one of the most rewarding experiences. Joey and I were talking a little bit before we started recording. Each two people on the episode have been completely different from each other, but they all share that core idea of exchanging ideas in a civil way, not screaming at each other, not doing punditry, and not hating on each other's viewpoint, but listening and finding communality or disagreeing, but not disagreeing with a vengeance, just exchanging ideas. And I think that's extremely refreshing and unfortunately also, I don't know, exceedingly rare.
Well, so few people have earned it. I don't think you have to be civil to people who are not worthy of it.
I have to say, ultimately, we are all people who come from a point of view. It doesn't matter which point of view you're from, even if I'm diametrically opposite from you, it doesn't mean that I can't hear you. I mean, it means that I am different than you. And currently, in this current political atmosphere, it's been missing for, I don't know, a couple of decades. I mean, I loved the eloquence of Obama. However, there was quite a bit of political divide over the last 12 years. I want to say 12 years.
12, 60, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Obama was I'm the last person who's going to jump to Obama's defense, but I think he almost, there's a right way and a wrong way to put this. He was purposely and overtly bipartisan, and yet was, you know, such a convenient focus of partisanship because of his background, because of some, you know, frankly, race baiting things that a lot of people did. I do think that was a big catalyst. And I think you saw it to a lesser extent during the George Bush years, where he very visibly, you know, represented kind of an archetype that a lot of liberals just find, you know, kind of intrinsically loathsome, the rich kids, Southern far right governor. So I do think that, I think a lot of it is the fact that people are purposely ginning up this divide based on personalities. And it's probably thanks to the system we have, the presidential system, where we can, you know, we do so personalize our politics. So I do think it's a purposely created thing, I think is what I'm saying.
I would have to agree with you. And in fact, in my perfect world, Mitt Romney wins the election and he's a moderate Republican. I don't care what we heard from recordings or whatever. He was a governor of Massachusetts. I know what he was. He was a moderate Republican. Had he won the presidency during his time, things would be dramatically different than they are today, because there would be that spirit of compromise.
You know, I live in San Francisco. The level of loathing of Romney was, you know, I think you would have, it would have been the same. Like I said, I really don't think it was anything peculiar to Obama or Bush or any other president, you know, besides things that can be stressed by the other side. You know, everybody tries to other the opponent. And I think there's plenty of that in Romney that could have been and would have been exploited to make him just as divisive. I kind of just think that's where we are now.
From the folders to the self-deportation, he definitely had a few things that...
Right. We used to have two parties that basically didn't really matter. You know, you had, you know, incredibly liberal Republicans along with, you know, incredibly conservative Western Republicans, and, you know, virulently white supremacist Democrats along with far left Democrats. So I think when people talk about the bipartisanship that used to exist back then, it didn't really, it was just cross partisanship. The fights within that system were just as vicious.
I agree with you in substance, but I don't agree with the translation of that. I mean, the reason why I feel like if Romney had won the election is just that Romney, one of the biggest problems that Romney had was that he had to placate the right to get the nomination. And the reality is that the right does not rule the Republican format.
No.
Neither does the progressive wing rule the Democrat format. I mean, if you took a temperature, if I stuck a thermometer up everybody's butt.
Woo-hoo! Quite the visual.
Party time.
Yeah. Ultimately, if we took the average would be, guess what? The average. It would be 10 degrees left of center or right to center. It would be within the 10 degrees plus or minus. That is where we are as a nation. However, because of the way that we vote, because of the way that we have Democratic National Party and Republican National Party. We don't kowtow to the moderates. We kowtow to the extremists. This is the reason why the Tea Party has won a lot of favor in the recent past, but now is out of favor. And it is the reason why the Progressive Party is going to be the downfall to the Democratic Party, which is pushing the progressive format versus the moderate Democrat Party.
I kind of disagree with what you're saying. I do believe people are moderate in the sense of they are moderate in their politics, but not necessarily their policy. So I think, you know, it's people like good government. And if you look at kind of the old in the Midwest, the old like the sewer socialists who, you know, ran governments, who were elected in places, they had quite radical politics, but they did them competently. So I think when people talk about, you know, moderation, that kind of thing, that's I think what people are saying is that they want people who are pragmatic governors in the, you know, general government sense, not necessarily, you know, as a governor of a state. But as far as policy, that opinions on that can shift really wildly to the far left or the far right, depending on, you know, it's the old Overton window concept, depending on what is considered acceptable. And I think when you say people don't kowtow to the moderates in the Democratic Party, I would say that's not true, in the sense of moderates being the more business friendly, you know, wing of the party, you know, more anti-regulation. And I think in that sense, in this current climate, you know, where people have gone through 2008, where you have, you know, wages not rising despite there supposedly being a labor shortage, you know, due to monopsony and monopolies and that kind of thing, I do think the progressive wing is ascendant in that sense. And I think you've already started seeing it with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York getting elected, all these op-eds saying, well, she's not really that radical. And as well, you know, she's very radical policy-wise, but pragmatic, you know, governance-wise. You know, she's running for Congress. She's just running a race. You know, looks like a plausible congressperson. And that's the sense I think people are kind of okay with moderates. You know, that's why they don't president accepted generally elect very outre kind of characters.
Did I actually understand you earlier correctly, Adam, that your feeling about Obama is that he did exactly what Joy says people don't, or the Democrats don't do, which is he did kowtow too much to the, I don't want to say to the right wing of the Democratic Party, but definitely not to the progressive wing.
Yeah, I think people put on Obama what their own personal ideologies was, again, you know, because he mm-hmm. visibly was not part of the mainstream. But in my opinion, Obama was a very articulate, very socially liberal Rockefeller Republican. That's how he governed. And that's how that's really his policies. He spoke to the liberal wing of the party and, you know, was able, you know, was able to very well connect with them on aspirational goals, and I think he did that amazingly. And it's, you know, a huge milestone for the country. In that way, he was a very transformative, very great president. I think ideologically he is a, you know, moderate kind of business friendly Democrat.
You know, I have to agree, because he was the deporter in chief.
Yeah.
He had no problem with drone kills.
Zero.
So I agree with you 100% with that.
Even the whole Obamacare was very much a compromise.
Oh, absolutely. My goodness. I'm sorry. You hit my problem. Okay, the Affordable Health Care Act was bottom line business friendly, and it was not American friendly.
And there was, you know, they had the votes and they had the pressure on the progressive side, which obviously wasn't strong enough at the time, but to go to the public option. But there wasn't.
Yeah.
And I know people say that, Obama, you know, he just wanted to be bipartisan. And I think there's some truth to that. I think he did see himself as that kind of divider type character. I do think that's where he did ultimately, you know, fall beliefs wise. I don't think there's anything dishonest about it. I think that those are his, you know, legitimately come by them honestly beliefs.
I think he gave and he took some of that. I still will always for the rest of my life credit Obama with the fact that he did get the insurance companies to agree that they could not refuse people on based on pre-existing conditions. And I think people underestimate, which I mean, I have a daughter who had a brain tumor, who still has cancer, technically speaking. And so for me, just the idea that one day she will be in a position where she will have to beg an insurance company to please insure her and they can tell her, I'm sorry, but here it says that even though you've beaten cancer, you've gone through all of this, and you're now 26 years old, sorry, but we don't want to pay for your insurance. That to me is just absolutely heartbreaking. And the idea that that time might be coming back, I credit Obama with the fact that he actually got that through.
Well, and that's why I consider myself and am, you know, a socialist and social democrat. For me, capitalism is an incredibly efficient system, but it's ruthlessly efficient. Yes. It's efficient like a virus is efficient.
Sure.
You need governors on it to keep it in check. It's just, the problem is it doesn't operate at human speed. You know, it operates at market speed, which is unfortunately leaves a lot of people behind.
So what you heard in background noise was me applauding. I came from England. So I spent a bunch of years here. And then I joined the military, and then I lived as a civilian in England during the poll tax riots, which, by the way, I was in the poll tax riots.
Hey, well done.
During Margaret Thatcher's era. Little known fact. Here's the thing. Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All is actually a very sane thing. It's not insane. It is completely sane. And a lot of people are trying to cast a bad light on it. But the reality is the only reason that we're talking about the Affordable Care Act is that it does all these wonderful things, blah, 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 blah. And ultimately, all it is insurance carriers covering
crap. It's a subsidy
crap
for the insurance companies.
100%.
The only way insurance companies make money is to deny claims. Like, it's really an industry that should not be privatized. It's like the post office. Like, you know, I mean, we know you do FedEx and that kind of stuff, but you need, it shouldn't be profitable to get letters across the country because it can't be profitable. It's like the military. It's, you know, you can't make money doing it despite the efforts of many.
By the way, I happen to love the post office.
I'm a huge fan.
And I buy stamps all the time.
It's amazing.
Do you have a collection, Joey? Do you have a stamp collection, Joey? We need to know that, I think.
No, I use them on purpose.
Uh-huh. Very practical collection.
It sounds suspicious to me. It sounds suspiciously like you might have a small collection stashed away somewhere.
Maybe somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that ultimately, why are we're talking about veterans' benefits for health? Why is it not take that money, throw it into Medicare, and give them Medicare? Because honestly, Medicare is better than what they have.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the people, like everybody's like, well, these poor people, they are under the poverty line, and they get Medicare, and they have better health care than me. Why do they have better health care than you? Because you're stupid enough to not have Medicare. And reality is, if we threw all of this money into Medicare instead of insurance agencies, we would have more money at the end, not less.
Such a violation of even the principle of the free market. You know, if you are a capitalist person, you don't have choice in healthcare. You know, I get insurance for my work like everyone does. We don't get to vote on that. We don't get to pick what plan it is, you know.
Right.
It's, and we've created this. I truly do it. Like, you just can't, I mean, you remarked that the very sad situation with their daughter and other situations. We're in this like world where you just pressure people and pressure people, and nickel and dime just existence. I truly believe if in like the next 4 or 5 years there's another 2008, people will be killed in the streets. You know, I mean, you just can't. It's not aspirational, but it's, people can only take so much. I mean, you know, the next time somebody gets, you know, a Wall Street guy gets a brick thrown through his window. You know, we're not that far from that.
Adam, with a dark, dark preview of our future, it's just going to turn into the purge over here.
Which I agree with.
You agree technically with the purge, or you agree that that might happen?
Well, I don't agree that the purge should happen. And by the way, I am sorry if I broke into the Massachusetts accent there. It happens from time to time.
I think this is sort of like that time when Rex accidentally got a phone call that he could answer in Korean. I doubt the fact that it was completely an accident. But we appreciate your accent, and we all live in the universe of one masshole on a daily basis. So another one definitely does not hurt. In fact, I think it engenders only positive feelings.
What's it, Bill? What's it, Bill Burr line? This is Boston is like racist San Francisco.
Wow.
Wait, wait, actually, now that we're on this, Joey, I totally forgot to, okay, this is like a complete aside. And after we're done with this, I promise you we're going to get back to a totally non-sequitur question about Twitter. But Joey, why did you leave Massachusetts?
I lived in a pretty big city in Massachusetts, Lawrence, and it has a bit of a crime issue. And me and my wife, and she was pregnant with our oldest child, we got evacuated from our apartment at 10 o'clock at night so they could use a car as a gun barricade to have a shootout with the guy on the first floor. And this was the SWAT team who evacuated us.
That's nuts.
The very next week, I was given the opportunity to move. They said, hey, we got some locations up in Vermont. Anybody want to go? And my hand went to the ceiling so quick.
Well, now you get to live in the wonderful socialist paradise of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That sounded very enthusiastic, Joey. You're really loving
and
that.
The sarcasm. I love Vermont. I really do. It's not cheap.
How do you feel about Sanders?
So I met Sanders. I met Sanders at Dunkin' Donuts.
Sure, there's
in
only five
Burlington,
people in Vermont.
Actually. And
spotted one of the other four was Bernie Sanders.
And believe it or not, he is exactly the same guy you see at the stage every day. That is who he is. He is no different than that. And while I don't believe he ever could have been a president, I do think that he has some smart views.
I'll always remember Lindsey Graham saying that Bernie Sanders is the most honest person in Washington.
Adam, how do you feel about Sanders?
I'm a big fan. Obviously, I actually did not vote for him in the primary last time because in California, you know, we're a little towards the end. And by that time it was fairly clear he was going to lose. And, yeah, I thought, you know, it was time for him to get out. I'm very much not a Hillary Clinton fan, but I did vote for her, in a pragmatic way, but yeah, no, I think he's great. I agree. He probably would have had a struggle to get elected. I tend to believe that any Democrat except Hillary Clinton could have won in 2016. So I do think he probably would have been elected president, but I agree that would have been a lift. I think he's probably the front runner in 2020, but I don't think he'll end up getting it. I think it's Elizabeth Warren's year, to be honest.
Ooh,
indeed.
Sorry, I'm with Julie on Warren. Okay, I think that she is a bucket full of problems.
She could be, but I remember when she was like a favorite guest on The Daily Show. Like, she's better at the campaigning thing than people give her credit for, I think.
Do you think she'll survive? I hate to even ask this question because every time he says it, it disgusts me so much that I can barely contain myself. But do you actually think she'll survive that particular slur? Do you think that's not going to stick in the same way that little Marco did Rubio or lying Ted did with
I think
Cruz?
That's already bitten him in the ass, and I think it'll bite him in the ass. I mean, how many – I grew up in the Midwest. How many people's grandparents told them that they had Native American blood? It's every single one of my friends. Like, you know, oh, we're part Cherokee. I mean – all she's got to do is, oh, I'm sorry, are you calling my grandmother a liar? Like, and he does it in such nakedly racist terms. I mean, he'll say it all the time, but it's not a crooked Hillary. It's crooked Hillary was an appeal to something that people kind of innately thought about Hillary Clinton, that, you know, she plays a little fast and loose with truth and ethics. I mean, he's literally just calling her like a liar or bad for saying she might have Native heritage. I mean, she's from Oklahoma. I think that's at best neutral, at worst pretty bad for him.
I'm actually fascinated how we went from understanding how there's apparently gradations of somebody being a liar, because if Hillary Clinton lied, I'm not sure that what we picked necessarily, how shall I say, ran the other way completely.
You know what? He's a truthful liar. People know he's lying to them. But he's lying in a way, like he's lying like a circus ringmaster, you know. Everybody knows he's not the heaviest man in the world, but you know, you want to be, he's bullshitting you. I knew I was going to curse. Hillary Clinton is just telling self-serving.
But you pay, no, but I agree. People wanted Barnum and Bailey. And
yeah, he's he's so, it's almost, it's when you just lie so nakedly and so dumbly, it just becomes a wash.
He had a boss, a previous boss, and thank goodness he's a previous boss, but he came in and he was all agitated, and he says, "Who are you going to vote for?" And I was like, "Dude, that's my business. Honestly, I haven't made up my decision yet." And he goes, I can't handle somebody who is a criminal. And at the end, right. I said, "So who are you voting for?" Because I had no idea who it was. Was it Trump? Because clearly he has done some unsavory things. And so has Hillary. Who's the dishonest person here?
Maybe both unpopular opinion, or I guess if only on the left, because people are a little scared to hope for it. I think the Mueller report is going to be really bad for Trump. Like you said, it's so clear. There was so much in the background and in the past that was so shady.
We're so going to get into this particular thing at the end of this, I promise you, because I'm going to have some questions for Adam and also some questions for Joey. But we'll totally go there, I promise. I really want to hear what you think about where the Mueller situation is legally going to go.
Oh, sweet promises. Sweet promises.
Yeah, I know. And we all know how Julie Mason feels about this particular topic. So I'm hoping the truth is at least somewhere in the middle and not totally on where Julie thinks it's going, which is not very far.
And that's my little inner voice is like going, yeah, of course, that's right.
If you cannot find criminal behavior within Trump's orbit, I think you will never find criminal behavior in anybody's orbit ever again.
They're not going to find any crazy Russian collusion. I don't think there was anything, you know, with Manafort, and there's stuff there was. What they're going to find is just some really pedestrian crimes. Michael Cohen's whole situation is, you know, it's just like general, like, taxi cab medallion fraud and that kind of, you know, just basic, you know, crime guys doing crime stuff.
Well, anyway, we'll leave it to the end, but we'll go back there, I promise. Meanwhile, I feel ridiculous even segueing back to this. But I'm going to ask it anyway, because I have to, because it says it here on my smart list of questions. When you using Twitter as a medium, do you use it apart from politics? Do you use it only for politics? Do you use it at all apart from sending questions to Miss Mason?
Oh, yeah. I'm always tweeting something political or righteously indignant or just a dumb joke. Twitter's just a horrible, horrible website that I use every day.
Okay, so some mixed feelings about Twitter, but still solidly addicted. I like it.
It's everyone's id just printed on the internet. It's the worst.
Oh, nice. I love that. That is very true. Joey, how do you feel about the Wild West of the Twitters?
By the way, while he was saying that, I was silently laughing my butt off. The reality is that I came into Twitter as a troll. I love the hashtag games and all that. And it wasn't until I found Julie Mason and the POTUS Press Pool that I found an actual real format for Twitter. and every once in a while, I will get into a Twitter war with somebody, and I always have this demarcation, and the demarcation is this. I will have a salient argument with somebody using facts until they insult me. The moment they insult me, I have won.
Oh, you are a troll.
That is actually not. I'm not sure that you understand how arguments on Twitter work, Joey. That's not the way it goes. And now to insult me is actually the beginning of the argument, and then you start to insult them back, and then other people pile on top of it and insult them even more. And before you know it, you have like a thread of 1,000 people insulting each other gleefully with various amounts of success. But that is kind of the way Twitter is supposed to work. So I don't know if just stopping once they start to insult you is really the way to go.
Well, all I can tell you is that at one point on Julie Mason, somebody said that this was just a liberal broadcast or whatever. And I was like, dude, are you kidding me? Honestly, like Julie Mason, in my estimation, It's only a thought. I think she is a little right of center, but that's my opinion and not what I know. And I was like, dude, Doug High, Siraj Hashemi. I mean, honestly, yeah. All of the Republican conservative people that she has on this program, you cannot sure. say that this is left or right. I don't give a crap. And I slammed him on that. And he was like, well, I'm sorry. It's only a few of them I've listened to. And so far, they've been liberal. And I was like, yeah, well, listen to a few more.
Civics class trolling.
maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to find some real trolls and send them your way. This is disappointing.
I wasn't the only one, though. I think there was like 15 replies. What about so-and-so? What about so-and-so? What about Breitbart? Right about that have been on her show that kind of like made him go, I'm sorry.
An apologizer. These are rare. That's a rarity. Speaking of people on the press pool, do you have a favorite Julie press pool moment that you remember, or do you have favorite guests that you look forward to and that kind of your ears perk up when they come on to talk about whatever it is that they're talking about?
Yeah, Jim Vandehei is always fun because he's never once laughed at one of my Ted Cruz jokes, and I'm going to break him. Because I know in my heart he finds that jerk off as morally despicable as I do. So he's always fun.
Come on.
Jim Vandehei, you will be someday. Broken.
Who? I don't know. They're all fairly fantastic. Anyone who's just very plugged in and you know, is actually bringing up I'm gonna butcher her name, but is it Soo Jung Kim?
Songmin Kim. Yeah, she's fantastic. Do you remember any favorite Julie moments? Do you have something like that, or does it just all blend into one solid ball of goodness?
Ooh, yeah, I don't know. It's a good show. I'm not sure if I have the greatest hits to mind, but it's a...
Okay, we're going to let Adam think about it. Joey, what about you? Do you have favorite journalists or guests or favorite Julie moments?
Absolutely. I mean, well, first of all, I don't think she has anybody who's subpar. Doug High and Tracy Selfie work so well against each other, and yet in such a subtle and civil fashion, you're actually able to see both sides at the same time. And Siraj is so he's a Celtics fan, and if you're a Celtics fan...
And that's who I meant, was Doug High, like, not Jim Vandehei. Sorry, Jim. You're great, too.
Oh, wow. Sorry, Jim Vandehei. You were mistaken for Doug High.
The only problem I have with Doug High is that his voice is so bass, and I have a bass head set in my in my car, so... Like, he makes my whole car vibrate when he
talks. You heard it here, Doug. Please talk in your head voice from now on so that you don't inconvenience those of us who have nice bass in their cars, because the entire car shaking is surely not a good thing.
As a fellow low voice ever, I apologize to anyone who, on the off chance, they're listening to this in their car.
So, yeah, the Doug and Tracy show, as per usual. Do you have any favorite Julie moment that you remember?
I hate to be selfish, and I'm going to be selfish. And I don't care, is when she reposted a picture of all the, Viking, horns that I post.
Did you say Viking horns?
Viking horns. Yeah. Because there was this whole discussion about how somebody at a Bernie Sanders thing had a Viking horn as a drinking flask. And I found at a, some kind of retro thing, whatever you want to call it, they had a whole booth devoted to Viking horn.
Write down a possible Christmas present for Julie Mason, purchase Viking horn.
But you got to get the stand that it goes into so it'll stand up when you put it down, because that was one of her big problems. Was she was like, boom. She's like, how do you put that down? You got to hold it in your hand the whole time.
Yeah, but see, that is just, doesn't it take away, though? I mean, if you're like, here's my Viking horn and it is currently filled with mead, and then you're like, and here's my Viking horn stand for when I don't use it anymore. That doesn't work. Like, it's either...
Oh, I bet the Vikings had stands for their horns. You don't want it to, like... fall down and get ruined. You got a nice drinking horn.
Either you got a Viking horn or you have a stand, but I don't think those two should go together. How do you think they all died?
Died of thirst.
Don't use the good horns.
My Viking horn has spilled once more. I do not know how to fix it.
And now, back to our family-friendly broadcast. Now, gentlemen, here it comes. I already had a request for this, by the way, today. Pooligans should discuss... SCOTUS pick Brett Kavanaugh. Now, we happen to have an attorney with us. Adam, how do you feel about the Brett Kavanaugh pick? And how do you feel about his nomination? And what do you think? Do you think he will be, in fact, confirmed? And what is he going to bring to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, of course he'll be confirmed. Full disclosure, I haven't practiced law in years. But I think he's a very typical Federalist Society, rather expansive power president type judge. I agree Roe v. Wade will probably be gone or pretty gutted within the next year or two. And I do believe if America falls apart, Mitch McConnell bears the blame for his nakedly unconstitutional and completely unethical blocking of a president's nomination to the Supreme Court, and I believe Obama deserves no end of opprobrium and disdain for not fighting harder for that.
We're talking about Garland now.
Yeah, he should have seated him and provoked a constitutional crisis and had it adjudicated, had it out. There was no back against the wall. Why not fight at that point? It's just a complete cowardly move, and I was incredibly disappointed, and I think that will really haunt and tarnish his legacy.
The reason why he probably did not is because nobody really thought that Trump was going to be president.
True. Yeah, no, they were completely, yeah, they thought they had it in the bag. They completely, yeah, that was one of the worst campaigns. And I truly find Mitch McConnell as utterly loathsome as Ted Cruz without any of the funny, ridiculous personality. He's just...
Cocaine Mitch did not a campaign song make. If you want to actually, if you want to ingratiate yourself, at least make a funny campaign
song.
Sure,
he may be the most effective legislator of the last 100 years, and I think he's utterly without morals.
Yeah, I would, as I think amply evidenced today when he was trying to excoriate the Democrats for not wanting to give his Supreme Court pick a fair shake.
You can tell he doesn't believe the stuff he says. You know, and he's like, oh, you know, we just deserve a good and open-minded here. I mean, he's smart enough and ruthless enough to know that that's bullshit. He's, you know, you almost have to respect him.
He also knows that should he not get away with it, his wife will beat up whoever disagrees. So she's tough. Joy, what do you think about Mr. Kavanaugh? Do you think that's a good thing, a bad thing, a doesn't really matter? How do you feel about him?
Okay, so winner, chicken dinner. I happen to believe that of all the picks that Trump could have made, this one's a good one. And that's probably unpopular in most of the hooligans' mentality. I happen to agree with a lot of the decisions he's made. I do believe that he is not perfect, and I don't think there is a perfect SCOTUS pick. I think that Trump actually kowtowed to the right part, that he actually kowtowed to the Republican Party to come up with this pick versus coming up with somebody like Bugs Bunny or, I don't know, some other fictional character, fill in the blank. I'd like to pick Derek Jeter.
I'm legitimately stunned he didn't pick his sister.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. It's not a big surprise. Like it really is not a big surprise. And dude, this guy's a Bush guy. So he's moderate.
This goes back to my point about Trump being dumb. He picks fairly standard Supreme Court picks because he doesn't care about this part.
Thank you.
He had his little list. Somebody said, yeah, pick from this list. And he said, fine, I don't give a shit about the Supreme Court. I don't understand what it does. I'm amazed I'm able to appoint people to it without, you know.
Will I get credit for it? Yes. Okay, fantastic. I'm picking.
And I have to say the big butt in here. He has picked somebody who is going to push for him to not be held accountable at that level because this justice has said, boom, like maybe Clinton shouldn't have been held to a big deal because guess what? He was a president and he had a lot of things to deal with. Why should we care about Monica Lewinsky and a cigar? Like, really? So there's that. And I think that was smart on Trump's point. And the other thing is is that this guy is a stand-up guy all the way along. There really is no reason for anybody to say no to this guy.
I actually asked this question today. I don't know whether you saw, but I was going to ask Julie. Unfortunately, my 6-minute delay on my iPhone app still is not fixed by SiriusXM. SiriusXM, if you hear this, fix your app.
Sirius, fix it.
It messes up my Twitter game, for God's sake. How am I supposed to stay relevant? Anyway, what I think happened is that he picked the one guy that for Democrats would probably actually be the most palatable were we not in a situation where any Democrat who agrees to go along with this will not be voted for come November, no matter who he will pick. Now, if they somehow manage to sink Kavanaugh and to drown him in paper, right, where they might actually feasibly be able to do. Well, the only reason for that would be on the one hand partisan, on the other hand it's what they know their electorate at this point expects. But what my question is, the only thing that Trump's gonna do if they drown this pick in paper is he'll go back to his list and he'll pick the next person who for all I know, from everything I've heard, is actually worse than the one that he currently picked.
And ultimately, this guy, the only reason why anybody has any crap against this dude currently is because of Roe v. Wade. And even in that, it isn't the decision of Roe v. Wade, it's the interpretation thereof.
Right, but there, I mean, as three men, I think we're all relatively ill-equipped to talk about the full, the full ramification of reversing Roe versus Wade. I really feel like he did not do himself any favors. If they actually are going to reverse Roe versus Wade, five male judges on the Supreme Court, I don't think they will be ultimately doing the Republican Party any favors.
Yeah, if you reverse Roe v. Wade, then you make the Supreme Court as salient an issue for the left as it's been.
Absolutely.
For the right.
Right. And that is it. Right. But it won't be the problem for him getting confirmed. It'll be a problem for him once he is confirmed. Then it's too late.
It almost makes more sense for them to let him through, because then it's the change is done. The sea change has changed, and then you can scare the hell out of people and get them out to vote.
My guess is that they're nervous about the fact that they may be seen as losers if they just let this happen. So they're going to fight with everything they have in order to keep a at least an appearance up of, being as democratic as they possibly can be and keeping people's spirit up. They don't want to go into November with an electorate that feels completely defeated by what just occurred and feels that their party was not helpful in trying to avoid it.
My prediction is that they will party line vote against him and he'll get in, and then it's... Mm-hmm.
So it's more about the fight than it is the victory. Yeah, absolutely.
I think so.
Because they want to...
You don't want to fight crazy hard in a fight you're going to lose.
Right. They want to make a big show. I mean, that... Ultimately, we're talking about politics here. Politics has little to do with actual governance and more to do with the show.
It's true, except in this particular climate, it really has had a lot to do with governance, because there are things happening, and we'll get to that in a moment. Actually, we can get into it now, since Joey works for our friends at the INS. immigration is one of those aspects of actual policy and governance that has definitely been affected by this particular administration, despite the fact that, as you both pointed out earlier, and that is true, Obama was known as the deporter in chief, and for good reason, and he definitely got pushback for that, not as much actually as he would have expected that he would, but he did to some degree. But there appears to be a sharp difference and marked difference between the way that these things were handled under the previous administration and the way that they're being handled now, where now there seems to be an emphasis on trying to intimidate, trying to scare, and trying to get to that result that is desired by inflicting maximum damage in a very public way, so that it can act as a deterrent. In your experience, how much have things changed? How much of it is perception, and also perception created by the media, and how much of it is actual change that has occurred?
I think it's a huge change. It's done. I mean, this is Stephen Miller's policy. Stephen Miller is a white supremacist, in my opinion, and it was a combination of a just completely cruel policy mixed with complete and utter incompetence, which is just growing. I mean, today I think they only reunited like 15 children or something like that. They've lost family members. It's I think the backlash has been extreme. I mean, you see people like Kirsten Gillibrand, who is a finger to the wind politician, who I also truly believe doesn't really have any true beliefs except a kind of general liberalness. I mean, she used to be a Blue Dog Democrat, you know, when that was a thing. She has jumped on the abolish ICE bandwagon. I think you really start to, I would guess, you know, really start to see the kind of reaction to this in polls going forward. I know today, I think the generic ballot poll was like the biggest advantage for the Democrats yet. I think this is a massive thing. This is Katrina-esque, if not more.
Now, leaving our mind open for a second, Joy, who actually has personal experience with how these things go down, were you already in your job during the previous administration, I assume?
Yeah.
How has it been for you? First of all, is that okay for you to talk about? And second of all, if you can, then tell us a little bit where maybe people just get it wrong because they don't understand the process.
There is little I can talk about as far as I am an employee thereof. The one thing I can say is that priorities change every administration. Every administration comes along and they push a different agenda, things that should be looked at more carefully. But ultimately, everything is codified in the INA, the Immigration Nationality Act. Because of that, we really can't change the way that we do business. We can only change the priority that we do business in. As far as ICE, and I'm not ICE, I don't give a rat's butt about ICE. Ultimately, they're doing a job that has changed priority, not that it's against the rules the way they were in their set of rules. And oftentimes people think, oh, yeah, you just come across with some new rules and this is the way it is, and therefore he's a jerk. The reality is that we all have to follow the laws and the rules and the regulations that are set aside by Congress. Congress is the only one who sets those rules, bottom line.
So that's a very good point. And we actually had a guest today on the, that we heard on the press pool. They were talking about ICE and the abolish ICE movement that Adam also mentioned earlier, which seems foolhardy to me, as was discussed today. ICE has definitely changed its priorities and has changed the way that it does business, but you can't get rid of ICE and be done with it. Somebody has to do that job, whether it's ICE or somebody else, whether you give it to a different agency of a different name or you somebody has to do that job, genuinely. So abolish ICE seems like one of those things that the right or Trump and his supporters can very easily pounce on and point to, and then all of a sudden they're otherwise ridiculous idea of Democrats want open borders and they love crime becomes somehow more palatable.
Yeah, it's a risk.
Politically, it's a Democratic loser, because reality is that we can all talk about the police and police in general, and we can talk about the way that they perform their job, and we can say, hey, they aren't doing this right. But I don't think there's an American from East Coast to West Coast that thinks, oh, gee, we can do without the police. And ICE is the police of the immigration.
I agree. It's a very risky strategy. I do think you're already seeing the talking point kind of develop of, you know, it's the repeal and replace thing. And I do think this has had the potential to have made the ICE brand so toxic that if you can sell that, hey, we're changing it with something else, I think that could be a win. But I agree. It's very possible that the Republicans could turn it around and make it a hammer.
I think it's dangerous. I mean, from somebody who's talking from center, and I mean, I am ultimately center, I would like to see the Democrat take a bit of a foothold, because it creates the most amount of equilibrium. I would like to see equilibrium in our Democratic process, and since we don't have a third party, I guess we have to talk about equal Democrats to Republicans, even though clearly I would rather see somebody else come along and pull up that third leg. With this, all they're doing is that they're creating a talking point which creates this. And this is what everybody other than Democrats will hear. And we're not talking about Democrats voting Democrats. We're talking about leftist Democrats. Mm-hmm. Everybody but the leftist Democrats are going to hear this. Oh, we want to do away with the people who take care of our borders. And the borders are a serious concern. They have always been a serious concern. As long as we are going to be the preeminent country in the North American hemisphere, borders are always going to be our issue. The only time that it's not going to become an issue is when we become a third world country to Canada and sure. Mexico mm-hmm. or Guatemala or whatever. And in that interim, hopefully that'll never happen. As long as we are the preeminent country in this hemisphere, we should be concerned about our borders. And we should be concerned about how we do business at that border. Do I want to see Japanese internment camps? Absolutely not. I think it was absolutely ridiculous back then. Do I want to see the camps that they're doing now? Absolutely not. I think it's ridiculous. But I think it's an intractable situation when we talk about people who do things illegally. And when and here comes the Trump point of view. When we see people who are doing things illegally and they're using children as a shield to that problem. When we see people come across the border and they are illegal, they are doing something illegal against the law, and we catch them and we do something against them, which creates a situation that we put the children away from them. And that's intractable. How do you fix that? Can you fix that? I can't. I can't come up with a situation that we can actually do something against the people who are doing something illegally and keep the children with the parents. How do we do that? I don't have a clue.
Two things and one real short thing up top. Just up top, you know, for small, this is a misdemeanor we're talking about, misdemeanor. For misdemeanors, don't lose your kids. You get, you know, released under your own recognizance. It's, you know, it's that kind of enforcement. But my two main points is that you made a really good point. Borders and immigration will always be an issue as long as the United States is the wealthiest country on the North American continent, because it's a supply and demand issue. It's, we have a lot of jobs that are paid at a wage that only immigrants will do, surrounded by a lot of countries that have desperate people from very violent countries, in the main created by policies that we supported in the past. So the only, to me, humane way to address that supply and demand issue is go after the employers, which no one has ever really supported doing, because those people are donors to both political parties. Last thing I will say is that, as just as far as the politics of it, you know, people talk about real America and small town America, and that's, you know, that's where I grew up. It's a valuable part of the country. Most people live on the coast. Most people live in big cities, and on the coast and in big cities are lots of immigrants and lots of people who interact with immigrants. And, you know, see them every day. And it's very hard to kind of maintain a just pure theoretical perspective on the issue when you know those people, when, you know, every restaurant or you know, your neighbor's babysitter or nanny or yard workers, like, you know, those guys and you can picture them getting deported. So I agree. Republicans could totally end up turning this into a cudgel and using it if they play it correctly. And they are better at doing that than Democrats are. But I think they are sorely mistaken if they think that's an easy silver bullet. I think the reactions to this policy just thus far are very indicative of that.
I think you made a really, really important point, which is employers. When Joey and I had a chance to talk about this a little bit yesterday, employers are definitely something that people tend to not go after. They only go after the people who do come here. I would also question whether a newfangled theory of America first does not in fact aggravate this particular imbalance that Adam was talking about rather grievously, and actually makes things considerably worse.
I'll also say one last thing too, like, not everyone who works for ICE is obviously a white supremacist or a racist. Can we say, like, most people who are white supremacists or racists and decide to join the government apply to ICE? Like, you see these videos of, you know, people kicking over bottles of water for refugees in the desert, and like just this indefensible, inhumane stuff. Like, there's an image problem that agency has. I mean, you've already seen, like, you know, there have been photographs of, you know, cops with swastika tattoos in certain departments. There's a definite image issue there.
I'd like to weigh in here, and that is to that when you see 2%, I'm just coming up with a number, 2% that are idiots, they're the 2% that are idiots. There are a bunch of people who took jobs with ICE because, A, working for the government is actually a good gig.
Absolutely.
And B, the mission of ICE is a good gig. And C, we're all Americans. And as Americans, we should want to see enforcement at our borders. And those people who see the job at the borders as an American mission might take up that job. And I'm not discounting that there are people who are idiots. I have seen idiots in every job from McDonald's on the way up.
I absolutely agree with Joey that there are always bad people in all kinds of jobs. The issue, of course, starts when, of course, somebody could theoretically poison you at McDonald's if they, you know, spread fecal matter on your burger. But the chances of that happening are just probably incrementally smaller than somebody in Border Patrol or in ICE being in a position where they could harm you or your life in ways that are sometimes even tough to quantify. And there are obviously a majority of agents who work for the government under the principle of we're doing the job that America asked us to do and we're enforcing these laws that exist. And then just like in police work as well, there appears to be a part of that population that perhaps has some other motives on top of what they're doing or understands the mission to be something slightly different. And those people can unfortunately inflict harm on a level that somebody who works at McDonald's probably could not. Would that be fair?
That would be fair.
And I'll never criticize, I've been broke, I'll never criticize someone for taking a bad job because that's the job you got to get. I understand that. That is what it is. But I have a kind of meta comment or question that I'd be curious to hear your guys' perspective on, which is, like, in North America, we're not really used to thinking of ourselves as historical countries, you know, our especially externally with our neighbors, since the history has been so relatively short as opposed to Europe. But I wonder if America is one of the reasons this is such a fraught issue, is that we've never really come to the terms with the fact that we really did steal the West from Mexico. I mean, if you read like the contemporary accounts of that war, it was a very divisive, I think it was Frederick Douglass who was like, you know, we should hang our heads in shame at the fact that we've, you know, just, it was not at the time, you know, an across the board jingoistic popular war, you know, at the time people criticized it as this grab. And, you know, to this day, you know, I'm living in a city named San Francisco. I wonder if there's a little bit of that in us that goes like, well, it could turn around, you know, it could be like this. Our borders are not all that immutable, and maybe we would kind of deserve it if it happened. Like, I wonder, I think that leads to some of that fear, you know, not even just plain racism, that kind of fear of immigration.
I'm a historian. I love history. I love the way that things happened, especially from World War I on, because I think they have a lot of impacts on the way that we do things today. With that being said, we really need to put that aside, and we need to look at today, and we need to see what effects we have implicated globally. And honestly, we have had such a great global impact in a social manner that we really need to take a look at that, and we need to react to that global impact, not to what our past has brought us to this point. What we did to Native Americans, horrible. What we've done since, a different thing.
I would have Native American friends who would disagree with you slightly on that particular point.
I think we should also ask some of those other countries that we've assisted with their opinions.
Well, I'm not going to say we didn't make mistakes. I mean, we have made a lot of mistakes, but we have made global impact. I mean, we have tried to replicate democracy.
Sure.
Throughout the world, when it suited us, and only and never the same as us, which makes no sense because evidently democracy sucks unless it's not the way that we do it.
Yeah, I mean, we have overthrown plenty of democracies and propped up really nasty dictatorships. Yeah. When we thought that would, you know, our idealism only goes so far. Yeah. I agree. I think in balance, you know, there's a lot of positive things, but I I think Americans err when we view ourselves as anything but another nation state that does things in a real politic way.
Ah, American exceptionalism.
American exceptionalism is amazing. A major fool. But honestly, we have really brought a lot of affluency to the rest of the world in a lot of big ways. And all right, if you go back 50 or 75 years ago, that might be different. But today, we actually do bring a lot of money to the outside world. And with that money, we also try to push our brand.
I think we have a similar trajectory as well.
Because we're like Coca-Cola.
We're doing new Coke
right now. We're doing new Coke right now. Exactly. Crystal Pepsi is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No Coke. I'd like to bring No Coke Coke.
Pretty good. You got a pretty good Trump there, my friend.
It's going to be huge.
We shall now segue to our new topic. Our new topic is called What the Fuck is Wrong with Alan Dershowitz? Yes, what he actually went on. Now, I know you haven't practiced law in a while, but I'm curious about this particular. So today's idea that Alan Dershowitz, who I believe teaches at Harvard, today's theory is Supreme Court could overturn a Trump impeachment. Now, that to me seems fascinating. I don't know how that would work, since impeachment is a political process and not a legal process, unless somehow he would bank on the Supreme Court changing the law of how an impeachment would work, at which point possibly they could weigh in. He's come so far from complaining about people not wanting to talk to him on Martha's Vineyard to now feeling like impeachment is something that the Supreme Court could possibly get involved in.
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz is a ghoul, and he's making very, like, these are arguments you can possibly have when you're, you know, a 1L in constitutional law class in law school, but him stating them with the certainty he has is ridiculous, and I don't think any true legal scholar is taking what he's doing right now as the height of his own legal scholarship. He seems to be fairly clearly out there selling his book that and being on the news a lot, which Alan Dershowitz likes, and being a figure of consequence, you know, that's what you do. But I mean, I've seen his interviews, and again, even I'm not a practicing lawyer, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but the terrible certainty he has over these incredibly, again, kind of eccentric arguments that he's making about executive power is, I think he's doing pro wrestling.
Yeah, he's doing pro wrestling, exactly. Sorry, Doug Hyde, that is a pejorative in this particular context.
Yes, it is. he found a role to play, and it's going to sell him a bunch of books, and he's on TV all the time, and I'm sure he signed appearance contracts at Fox and MSNBC and CNN, and he's out there.
Very, very bizarre human being. Do you have any Dershowitz opinions, Joey?
Why, as a matter of fact, I do. Believe it or not.
Oh, surprise.
I'm from Massachusetts, and I have an opinion. I got to give it to the WWE version. He is Brock Lesnar, brings a lot to the table, but doesn't do jack. He's Rudy Giuliani, only Rudy Giuliani light. In other words, he's not quite as crazy as Rudy, but says the same crap.
Yeah, honestly, is pretty like suffering dementia.
Oh my gosh.
Is that a serious question?
I'm being dead serious. I'm not joking at all.
Rudy is, honestly, it's almost like he's trying to find his own reality show. He's like, if I say crazy crap, sooner or later, they'll give me a show. Because he says the stupidest crap. Well,
people always bring up how like Trump used to be articulate back in the day, but look at videos of articulate Rudy back in the day. Like the difference between now and then is astounding. Like he's not even an adult.
Beautiful people. Yeah,
exactly.
There's 8 words in the Trump vocabulary. There's 6 in Rudy's.
I really believe they're especially men of a certain age who literally lost their minds after 9/11. Like I put Cheney in that category, like people who just have like a PTSD and went kind of nuts.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, he has been writing on 9/11 since 9/11. I mean, he wasn't that great before it. And then for him to, so much like Bush, take the opportunity and do well with it, and Bush did, Giuliani did. I mean, ultimately, they are nothing more than what they were before the situation happened. And Bush was actually not so bad. Rudy Giuliani has always been an ego trip.
Well, and he was, people forget, he was despised before 9/11. I mean, he was leaving office with a horrific record and did not handle the aftermath of 9/11 particularly well. He was good in those days. But I mean, there are all the issues with, you know, the compensation for the firemen and the
ugly business. I remember that Jon Stewart show where he brought those first responders on. Ugly business with what they did to those first responders, or rather, what they did not do for those first responders. Yeah,
it's that thing that we talked about at the beginning of wanting a strong man. You know, he was very much that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and it's astonishing how many times he can be on television. And when asked questions about any sort of semi-particular, it suddenly turns out that despite the fact that he finds himself highly qualified and how close he is to the president, he's still on a fact-finding mission of rather basic facts about things that he's currently representing.
Yep. And that's just pretty good lawyering.
All right, now we've had enough lawyer talks, and now we're going to focus on something that people actually care about. Joy has identified himself as a connoisseur and appreciator of pizza. And we now need to explore, for the last bit of our program here, the ins and outs of the pizza. First of all, and probably the most pressing question, fork, yes or no?
Hell's no.
No, that's the only thing we want to be deported for.
What I got to say about pizza is there's only two kinds of pizza, not three. Chicago deep dish pizza, delicious, yes. Pizza, no. I'm sorry, Chicago. Go away.
So yes, it's a bit of a lasagna.
Exactly. It's not pizza. There are two kinds of pizza. Oh, yeah. There's nothing wrong with it. It's delicious. Cheese and sauce and bread. How can you go wrong? But there are two kinds of real pizza, and that is the Italian-style pizza, which is double-baked. You bake the crust once with a little bit of water on top to keep the top smooth and luxurious. And then you put the sauce on and the cheese on after you drain off the water.
You're turning me on a little bit right now. Yeah. I'm not going to lie.
It should not be too much cheese. It should be enough cheese, but not too much cheese. And it should be sweet, a little sweet. And that's Italian. That's delicious.
Very important.
And then this Massachusetts Greek pizza, which is a thicker crust with a lot of freaking cheese. I'm talking a lot of cheese. When you're talking a lot of cheese, I'm talking if you take it hot and you cut a slice off and you pull it away, you're going to leave a cup of cheese on the plate and still have cheese on your slice. That is Greek pizza. And it should be oily as all get out.
I guarantee you that the moment he hears this, Bubbles, who just arrived on the West Coast, is running back to his car and driving to Massachusetts in order to try a Greek pizza.
Greek pizza is nothing like it. Funny story. So I moved up to Vermont, and before I moved up to Vermont, I would walk down the ethnic aisle. They actually had something called an ethnic aisle, which is, you know, non sequitur. Anyways, so I go down this aisle, and on one side they have Jewish foods, and on the other side they have Mexican foods. And by Mexican, we're talking El Paso. That's it. That's the entire aisle. Mm-hmm. There's no Goya. I'm sorry. Small section of our soap.
Sounds shameful.
Oh my gosh, it was so.
Come to California. See our. Our section.
I mean, I'm from a place where you go from one corner, you get Dominican food that is amazing. You go to the next corner, you get delicious Italian. I cooked with people in the kitchen that with cigarettes hanging out our mouths while we cooked Greek food. Yeah, it's back in the day. So we used to do that.
I'm from the Midwest, so, you know, I'll say that I do love our Detroit square pizza. It's fine, but I can't bring a ton of knowledge to the table. But I will say that as a West Coaster now, pineapple on pizza is awesome.
I want to shoot you.
My former writing partner, who is Hawaiian, just recoils every time he sees a Hawaiian pizza, which is only deemed a Hawaiian pizza because of some pieces of pineapple. That gets him every single time.
Why would you do that to a slice of pizza? You know what a slice of pizza is? Sauce, cheese, and bread. That's it.
You got a little sweet, you got a little salty. Nice.
not saying it isn't good. I'm just saying it's not pizza.
Fair.
As a Swiss person who grew up in Switzerland, like actually, you know, I don't know, within some hours of the Italian border,
sure.
We had actually Italians that immigrated to Switzerland and started pizzerias. I was not aware of the Great Pizza War until I came to the United States, because I had no idea. Like all of a sudden I came to California, all of a sudden there's a deep dish. I'm like, what? Why is it deep, and where's the, what is it? Since when is a dish a part of any kind of pizza? I fully do not understand. And then it turned out that there was an entire cultural war of pizza going on in the United States that no European has ever been aware of. So I'm fascinated by this phenomenon.
I will say a shout out to European pizza. I do enjoy a good European pizza. A little egg on top. It's nice.
Ooh.
It's different. It's very different.
Yeah, they're regarded as rather classic and not as, I don't know, not as desirable. I guess every state came up with its own version of what a pizza should be. And
American pizza is really, that is an American thing.
You know the worst pizza dough in the entirety of the European continent?
Domino.
Domino's is the worst here.
I ordered Domino's in Switzerland. I thought I was being hilarious and was having Domino's in Switzerland. I could not tell the actual pizza from the box. I'm now quite convinced that had I just poured a little bit of salt on the box, it probably would have been more tasty than the pizza itself. It was absolutely horrifying. But the pizza phenomenon in America is just fascinates me endlessly. I just get all the different tribalism, and then our friends in California with their California pizza kitchen, it's changed the game over here in California.
Yeah, we love nothing more than putting arugula and peanut sauce on anything.
That's delicious, but it's not pizza.
Sure, you know that. I'm totally with you on that.
We have, well, I guess we don't actually have that many Italians. we don't actually have that many Italians. There are like a couple of decent Italian places. But when my family comes here and they want to go eat out Italian, they want to go eat Italian food, I always have to post a disclaimer.
Do you bring them to an actual Italian place?
I try, but then we did that one time actually, and the restaurant, the people who work there, but when they realize that you are European, the menu tends to change.
Really?
Oh wow! Oh, funny.
You know, they're like, oh well, no, well no. If you're from Switzerland, then let us tell you, we don't order this. Don't order this. We're only doing this because people here want it.
We have red tape.
Let us bring you something. And then they like go back there, and then you get like the food that the grandma in Napoli used to cook for the actual guy who's back there. Mm. And then the ziti come out and things improve.
Yeah. That's like Chinese food up here. If you go with a Chinese speaker, you get the real stuff.
Oh yeah, that's true. Chinese food in San Francisco. Don't even get me started.
I miss Chinese food. We used to go to Boston every weekend, and we'd go to this
great Chinese place. Food.
And when we first went there, they would drop chopsticks and a napkin on your table, and they would bring by food, and nobody spoke anything but Chinese. After we had been going there for a couple of years, somebody dropped silverware on our table and talked to us in English, and I was like, I'm sorry, this is not right. Give me the good stuff.
They started to like you less as you went there more. Is what you're
saying? The place had gotten so popular that we started to fade into the white background of people who went there. So Chinese people who were there who didn't know us thought we were just part of the white noise that would show up.
Gentlemen, We've been doing this for 2+ hours, 2 hours and 7 minutes to be exact.
Dude, sorry.
Right now. No, why are you apologizing? It was super fun, but I do feel like, first of all, Joey probably should now finally check on to see whether his 5 children are factually asleep or are still somehow spread around the house doing things other than looking for slumber. And Adam just came like literally straight from work and has not had a second.
Yeah, I should actually eat some dinner.
Oh, yeah. I was very sorry about that, Adam. So I think unless anybody has some last remarks or questions, we're probably, as sad as I am to say it, we'll start wrapping this up.
No, this is a blast.
I do have one remark. This goes out to Julie Mason. Thank you for bringing together the greatest group of people so that we can actually listen to a nonpartisan version of the truth. Thank you.
That was very sweet. And I think very true. I think I would second that, and Adam might actually second that as well. Absolutely. I think it's really been a blessing. And thank you both so much for taking the time on a random Tuesday to do this with me and have this conversation. I really, really appreciate it. I would like to remind our listeners that you need to follow these two at Joey Tomatoes and at Bull Goose Party. They are, as you now know, over the past 2 hours at the very least have learned, they're well worth your time, and they both always have interesting and hilarious things to say. So please follow them on Twitter. They've been amazing. Thank you guys so much. And I think with that, this 5th episode of the Pooligans podcast is officially out.